crowd. You've been far too agreeable the last few days.
Isn't that what you demand of me, Empress? He asked.
Nero smoothed down the black silk of his fitted shirt. He never wore any other color, but there was always an embellishment to draw the eye. Today, it was one tiny brass button high on his neck, centered between his rounded collars. His precision instilled fear in her.
I'll admit, I'm impressed you survived, he said. But that doesn't put you anywhere near the same league as me. We'll see if Kalu will accept you as a ruler, and your narrative of peace.
So you're waiting for me to fail?
That was Siotra's mistake. Waiting for you. The world waits for no one. It rewards those who take action, however unprecedented or unconventional that action might be.
And they want someone who will. He paused, as if he was being careful of his words.
It put Rhee on edge. The people want someone who will tell them what to believe, and make them believe it.
He smiled. You've certainly done that, Rhee said.
Nero actually shrugged. Not quite yet. A chill ran through her. They could barely stomach your rule when it was legitimate. And now that you've reappeared, there are theories circulating that you orchestrated your own kidnapping and that you've taken a Fontizian lover.
Rhee straightened up then. Dalin. And these Theros had a nefarious origin, I'm sure.
It was low and stank of exactly the kind of thing Nero would do. He was spreading rumors about her. At least, reminding her of his ability to do so.
Me? Of course not, he replied easily, though the smile that played on his lips suggested he took credit and was glad for what he'd started.
And yet, if I had decided it was truth, it would become truth, you know. That is what real power is.
Nero paced.
Rhiannon. Do you know how a rumor begins?
Not by the utterance of what is obvious,
but by a mere seed.
An uncertainty.
A still of you and Dalin at the wrong angle, released on the hollows.
The avalanche of questions. You needn't tell people the worst. They will imagine it for themselves.
Because there is no greater power than the power of the mind. Empress.
He cast an image of Dalin into the air between them. Dalin was holding Rhee's hand, grabbing it in all likelihood to pull her to her feet, and she was looking up at him in irritation. But somehow, captured from this angle, her face appeared to be saying something else entirely. Nero still had that serene smile on his face. She wished, more than anything, she could just cut it off.
Now, let's go meet the adoring crowd.
Rhee gathered up the stiff hem of her dress and walked past him, brushing his shoulder as hard as she could. He stumbled, but still seemed amused. A petty move for an empress, she knew, but she didn't care. She stepped to the edge of the balcony with as much confidence as she could spare. Nero stepped out behind her. Each soul was so tiny, indecipherable from another in a way that made the entire crowd seem like one living organism. It pulsed, as if it were breathing. She couldn't help but imagine it rearing up and swallowing her whole.
I now introduce the extraordinary Empress Rhiannon Ta'an. We ensure a new worthy leader,
Nero boomed. Rhee recognized the phrase. It sounded like he'd pledged his fealty, made his loyalty public for all the galaxy to hear. But it belied his true ambition. Nero had said the same thing to Rhee after her parents died 10 years ago. Then, too, he'd been referring to himself. He caught Rhee's eye and grinned, his mouth stretched wide, grotesque in his happiness. Then he added, in a falsely solemn voice, "Though I add my prayers to hers, that Princess Jocelyn may soon return safely to us." Revulsion gripped her whole body. Had she played right into his hand? She didn't put it past Nero to use Rhee to bait Jocelyn, playing off her fears for Jocelyn's safety. She had announced a reward for Jocelyn's return, after all. Once the royal sisters were reunited, he might simply kill them both. After all, why remove one Ta'an when another was still out there? It was the perfect explanation for why Nero hadn't harmed Rhee yet. Nero grabbed her hand. Another jolt of revulsion coursed through her. This was the man who'd killed her family. What if she said that now, she thought wildly, for everyone to hear? She knew what it looked like, their hands clasped above them as if they'd won. And she had won, hadn't she? They were about to announce a ceasefire. He was meeting with the United Planets tomorrow, and he'd so much as agreed Kalu would pull Uniforce troops out of all Phuntizian territories. It was a public arrangement to dial back the war. But even as Rhee spoke these words to the crowd, her mind spun. His nearness disgusted her. The corset pressed her ribs like a vise. The towers of the Long Now reflected the sun at its height. It nearly blinded her. She looked down to see the lower balconies of the palace crowded with servants who looked up at them like they were gods. Rhee's heart skipped a beat when she saw a figure on the balcony just two floors below, leaning against a pillar in a way that looked moody and familiar. "Is it Dahlan?" she thought. But no, it was a trick of the light, or a trick of the mind. Because she blinked once, hard, and when she opened her eyes, she saw it was Julian who'd taken the figure's place. He shook his head, and though she couldn't see his expression, she could feel his glare. And to the shouts of the crowd and Nero's too tight clasp, she watched as the boy who was once her best friend retreated. She felt sick, heartbroken as she gave her speech. What danger had she put him in? When she finished, she half ran, half stumbled back inside. Once she crossed the threshold, she fell to her knees. Nero entered behind her. "You did beautifully, apart from the mishap at the end, but we'll edit it out when we air it on the Hollows."
"You said it would be live."
"It's never live." He let out a tiny sigh. Rhee clenched her fists. "You talk about constructing a persona as if it were the most natural thing in the world, but that's not even close to the truth. You take real life and you twist it, pervert it, so that... Was she talking about Nero, or what she had done to Julian, or both? Nero kneeled before her, so that they faced one another on the floor. "Real life is boring, Empress. Who wants that?" Then he stood again. "Make sure you're rested for the slate of appearances," Nero added in the wake of her silence. He exited the room, and Rhee leaned forward on her knees, her head touching the floor. She felt suffocated, and she tried to rip off the outer layer of scratchy cloth on her dress. It tangled up around her wrists. She'd forgotten there was no way out of it. Not on her own. Chapter 16. Kara. Kara was swimming, trailing behind her mom, Lydia, who was fully clothed, cutting through the blue-green water.
"You lost your memories, too," Kara tried to say,
but her mouth flooded with the taste of salt water. She was falling behind. Her hands were bound too tightly. She thrashed, and the rope burned her wrists. She gasped, swallowing stale air. Kara felt a rocking movement underneath. It turned her stomach upside down. There was a vague memory of being forced into an old shipping container. The walls reeked of plastic and oil, and another distinctly human scent. She didn't want to consider its origin. Maybe it was her. She opened her eyes. The shipping container was large and rectangular in shape. Reality crashed down on her, waves and waves of it. Her body heaved. She rolled over on her side and threw up. Someone groaned. Kai. Kara wiped her face. The sour taste of bile took over her mouth. She'd come so close to the truth for it to end here, en route to Nero. And suddenly, Kara wondered how Rhiannon had survived all that time she had been on the run. Rhiannon Ta'an had evaded death over and over again, and here Kara was, the lesser sister, the lesser everything, lured into a trap the second she had been left alone. She pushed herself up to sit, but her elbow gave out when the shipping container swayed back and forth on its magnetic tracks. She crashed back down to the ground. She was exhausted.
"Is it really her?"
someone said. Kai. He didn't sound convinced. Kara felt the pill Diak had given her beginning to slip out of her pocket. She angled her body as if she was ashamed and secured it deeper into her pocket without them noticing. She wondered about the DNA moving inside of her. Her jaw hurt and her skin felt tight, and she wondered how much she'd actually changed.
"She looks more like a Ta'an in this light," Imogen said.
Kara recognized that tension in her voice, the way the girl doubted it herself and felt the need to insist.
"What if I'm not?"
Kara had surprised herself by saying it. Her voice was nearly a whisper.
"Wouldn't it be a shame if you couldn't collect that reward?"
"Shut up," Imogen said. "And you, ignore her. Let Nero deal with it."
Kara's legs ached. Her hair fell across her face and stuck to the sweat on her neck. It felt thicker, looked darker.
"You're going to drop me off at his doorstep? This is your brilliant plan?"
Kara pressed. She looked between Imogen and Kai. The other captors were gone, and she guessed they'd been left behind.
"The plan has worked out so far," Imogen said. "We got Diak, lured you out, and here you are."
"You killed that man."
"I've killed lots of people."
Kara was suddenly aware that the salt water she'd dreamed of was really just vomit in her mouth and on her face. Her plan to use the overrider to wipe Jocelyn from memory had grown even more slippery, more complicated. To erase Jocelyn from everyone else's memory, Kara would have to forfeit her own. She closed her eyes, humiliated, and wondered how they would deliver her to Nero. If he would kill her, or worse, if he would demand she serve him. Etra, Rillerinus, Samba, she repeated to herself. The wolf, the guardian, the matron. She couldn't forget those star coordinates, or give up hope on finding the overrider. She'd prefer to be no one than Jocelyn Ta'an. Then a thud sounded overhead, and Kara looked up as if the ceiling might tell her something. Imogen looked up, too. She was silent for a beat, then nodded for Kai to check it out. Kara huddled in on herself. It could be someone trying to save her, or it could be someone else trying to make good on Nero's ransom, and they could be even more vicious than present company. Kai walked past Imogen toward the end where the container opened. Kara's heart sped up when he lifted the cover suddenly, but no one was there. There was just a row of shipping containers behind them, all floating along the same magnetic tracks. He peeked out to the left and right, but he didn't see anything. At least, judging from the stupid grin on his face when he turned around. Then, two legs swung over the edge of the roof, kicking Kai in the chest. The force of it sent him flying back into the shipping container, scattering Kara and Imogen apart. Issa landed in a squat at the edge.
"I know what you're thinking,"
Issa said. I make this look easy.
Kai and Imogen both rushed her, and she easily dodged Kai, spinning and kicking his back to propel him forward and out of the container. Kara heard his scream drowned out by the wind. While Issa's back was still turned, Imogen pushed her out of the container, or tried to, but Issa dodged her, and they struggled as Kara watched. It was almost picturesque from where she stood, how their fight was perfectly centered by the square opening of the container, the landscape of green fields and wildflowers sped out and away from them. One misstep, and either one of them could go flying out. Whoever fell wouldn't survive. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the gleaming metal of Imogen's silver whip, abandoned on the floor. The two girls struggled, punching and wrestling, but Imogen was sleeker, slippery almost, as she slunk out of every hold. She flipped Issa and pinned her down, choking her with her bare hands as she squatted over her body. Issa kicked her legs out frantically. Kara's heart thudded. She crept up from behind and scooped the whip off the floor as silently as she could. Rage and fear, she felt it taking over her entire body, her entire world. Kara held her breath, saw her bound hands shaking as she pulled a section of the whip taut, squeezing her hands around either side. Once she was close enough, a term came to her. Striking distance. She swore she'd never heard it before, but at the same time, she knew exactly what it meant. The fear spiked in her chest, cutting off her air. She realized she couldn't breathe, and it scared her. But there were other things that scared her more. Like Issa dying because Kara had been too much of a coward to save her. "Do it, do it, do it," she said as she moved close to Imogen's back. And then, Kara did. She looped it around Imogen's long neck and yanked as hard as she could, closing it tight, then tighter, bringing her hands together just at the base of Imogen's neck. The girl flailed, awkwardly trying to reach behind her, slapping at Kara. But Kara stood her ground and barely felt it. She barely felt anything. The only sensation she knew was her heart thrumming in her ears. Even when Imogen skittered back, nearly fell as she kicked out wildly, Kara made herself stone. She was vaguely surprised by how strong she was. Issa sat up and caught Kara's eye. She pushed herself up to stand. Her neck was red and raw as she came over to Kara's side, took hold of the whip, and nodded for Kara to ease her hands away. Issa squeezed harder than Kara could have. Now she heard the sputter of Imogen's breathing, and finally, when her body went limp, Issa held the stranglehold there longer. Much longer. Unbearably long. Kara understood they couldn't take chances. When enough time had passed, Issa let Imogen's body fall forward gently, until she was just a pile of pretty skin and bones on the ground. Kara looked out at the shipping containers behind them, at the endless field of tall grass and wildflowers unfurling before them. They were still on Raleigh.
"How did you get here?"
Kara swallowed. There was a foul taste in her mouth.
What happened?
"I tracked you back to the facility where they kept you," Issa shrugged. "When they dragged you back out, I followed you to the shipping containers and hopped on when no one was looking."
They had gone to the market in the afternoon. Judging by the sun, it was now mid-morning. 12 hours had passed, maybe more. By now, the med craft was long gone.
"You came back for me. Again," she muttered.
Somehow, she had earned Issa's loyalty. She might never understand it, but she was grateful. Her heart hurt from the gratitude, from the pain of caring again, when she had wanted so badly not to have to care about anyone ever again.
"Didn't have anywhere better to be," Issa replied. But through her sarcasm, Kara saw her bravery, her fierceness.
Whoa, are you okay?"
Issa was reacting to Kara's expression. She was on the verge of crying. Her face, her new face, felt hot and sticky. Her head hurt, and she knew it was because her DNA was changing, twisting. She dug the heels of her palms into her eyes again, rubbing.
I guess I'm just not used to people coming back for me.
The anguish in her voice was obvious, but she could do nothing to hide it. Issa touched her forearm. Do you want to talk about it?
Not now, Kara said, shaking her head. She wasn't sure if she ever wanted to talk about it.
Well, when you do, I'm all ears, yeah? She looked around. We'd better hurry. I'm sure Uniforce isn't thrilled to be called out for wild goose chases. We want to make sure we don't give them a target. With any luck, we can hitch a ride on a light craft and catch up to the frontline physicians.
Kara took a deep breath and wobbled on her feet. I have to go to Rayta, she said.
She felt unexpectedly clear, focused. She knew where the Overrider was.
Issa stared at her. There's nothing on Rayta but ashes.
Kara shook her head. There's a weapon hidden there. We have to find it before the Uniforce does.
Issa squinted at her. What kind of weapon are we talking?
Kara hesitated, but only for a second. Issa had just saved her life. Kara would have to trust her.
You told me that you worried that Uniforce was trying to force an update so it could track your cube, getting data from it. But what if Kalu could go a step further? What if they couldn't just track your cube, but change it?
For a second, Issa said nothing. Then, abruptly,
I knew it!
She stomped her foot on the floor of the shipping container.
Some of us did. Most everyone thought we were paranoid. You're saying this tech is on Rayta?
Kara nodded. We need to figure out a way, through the military cordon.
Not anymore, Issa said. Princess Rhiannon announced a ceasefire. I've been using the third eye to pick up holo transmissions. Fontys had to release the protections on Rayta, which means we're free to go.
And so is Nero, Kara said. Issa nodded. There were no coincidences. It was as if Rhiannon knew where she was headed and was clearing the path for her. As if she could feel deep down that this is the only way that they both would be free of Jocelyn, the lost princess, forever.
But it was just as likely Rhee was helping Nero.
No, Kara refused to believe it. Either way, she needed to get to the Overrider first.
If there's any chance of foiling Nero, the WFC will want to help, Issa said. I can broadcast a distress signal as soon as we get back to civilization.
Kara was comforted when Issa wrapped her in a hug and gave her a squeeze.
I hope you're ready to escape a moving shipping container, she added dryly.
She had told Issa they needed to destroy the Overrider before Nero got his hands on it, and that was true. But what she couldn't tell Issa, what she would never tell Issa, is that she planned to use it first. Then, Jocelyn Ta'an would disappear forever. Maybe Kara's own memories would disappear too, but she could start making her own choices from then on out. She could be free, and no one would tell her who to be.
Chapter 17 Alyosha. Allie's veins felt like they'd been pumped full of fire. They were going to take Nero down. There was something about it. Poetic justice or irony or whatever it was. Returning to the rubble that had once been his home. Let Nero come for the Overrider. Allie would be waiting. They were speeding toward the remains of Allie's home planet on one of the smaller and stealthier WFC crafts. But they had to hurry. With Rayta's airspace now cleared for travel, it would be a free-for-all soon, and Nero could easily beat them to the punch. Pavel stood at attention, with the holo projection beaming carefully from his chest plate. Dalin circled the image, analyzing it closely. Blue-green light came off the image, bringing out the hollows of his face and the narrowed expression he wore when he was thinking hard. Allie fought the small voice inside him, the one that warned he'd become a pawn all over again. This time, for the Fontizians. But the idea spun and sharpened itself on the memory of Kara's death. This time, the game was his to win.
Alyosha, your blood pressure and body temperature are elevated. Would you like to review meditation techniques?
Ali leaned forward, his palms flat on the control panel. Vin had programmed Pavel with wellness alerts before he died. Ali felt a piece of his heart splinter off, lost to the void. He shook his head.
I'm good, P. How about you just give us the status?
The droid blinked his eye lights and zoomed out of the hologram to include the flight patterns of 5 different crafts. All Uniforce, meaning all Neros. They were mining vessels, which must mean whatever he was looking for was underground. The Overrider was underground. One piece of good news, the mining vessels were headed to different locations across the fractured planet. Ali was relieved. Apparently Nero didn't know where the Overrider was. Not exactly. But just as quickly, anxiety flared in his chest.
So how do you figure we dodge all these treasure hunters?
Ali asked.
If you got some invisibility tech I don't know about, expedite the shipping on that and maybe we'll get it tomorrow.
We will not dodge them. Dalin ignored his sarcasm. We will commandeer one of their vessels. We will become one of them.
What?
But even as he reacted, Ali understood. So Dalin had seen the revolutionary boys after all. You expect me to commandeer one of the Uniforce crafts?
That's the idea, Dalin said neutrally.
Seems like that idea has more me than you. But already Ali was making calculations, using parts of his brain that felt as if they'd rusted into place. He missed Vin's crazy piloting, his focus and adrenaline. He missed the language they shared of all the shortened military terms and the inside jokes they'd collected along the way. And suddenly, Ali was pissed all over again. That it wasn't Vin sitting next to him, but Dalin. He looked over at the Fontizian, weighing his options. They'd have to do it soon, before they got too close to the electromagnetic field holding Rayta together, and the hijack came on everyone's radar. He looked closer at the hovering image.
Taking into account thrust and nearby gravitational bodies, Pavel said, it looks unlikely that any of those crafts will be making a pit stop between here and Rayta.
Ali nodded.
But nothing's stopping us from going to them, he said.
They stayed up all night reworking their plan. The Nanak was their target ship, a mining vessel equipped with 2 huge drills at the bottom, so powerful they'd be liable to drill through any rock and fall out the bottom. They sent a small strike team to pierce the Nanak's fuel chamber and run its fuel down. When the crew on board eventually noticed, they did exactly what anyone would. They hailed a service craft. Ali and Dalin were on that particular service craft with a crew of Pavel, Hesse, Daris, and the scrawny Fontizian messenger, Ramal. Ali had to admit that the WFC had come through. Their service craft had come from a raid on a collusion territory during the First Great War. The ancient refueling rocket would have made the revolutionary look shiny and new, but it was nearly impossible to track, and one of their sources had provided them with a code needed to communicate with the mining vessel. Phase 2. Once they attached to the Nanak, they'd board like old-school pirates and take the crew hostage. Phase 3. Land the Nanak and intercept Nero on the ground. Phase 4. Break his fucking neck. It was reckless, but Ali didn't care. A collusion-allied ship would give them weapons, power, and cover, even in plain sight. It would give them the advantage. He grabbed onto the armrests and felt the G-force bear down as they rocketed toward the Nanak. He tried to will himself to feel good, cocky, like the old days when it was him and Vin. But as they approached the atmosphere, the rocket vibrated. Allie could practically hear the bolts unscrewing. His stomach heaved. He thought back to the day Vin died, how the tin soldier had broken apart like an egg and spilled them out all over Nidaz. That had been his fault. He'd been a petty kid who'd slacked on the navigation. Vin had cracked open his head because of Allie. Dolan leaned toward Allie as much as his harness would let him. "I hadn't expected these soldiers to be your first choice," he said easily, like his lungs weren't being pressed down into the pit of his stomach. Show off. Still, Allie was glad for the distraction. Hating on Dolan made it easier to push Vin out of his thoughts. Allie looked back at Hesse and Darris, the two soldiers he'd asked to join them. They were dressed in matching spacesuits, strapped into mounted chairs arranged in a circle around the craft's center console. Hesse, who was even wider than Jeff, was gritting his blunt, wide teeth in agony. The G-force probably felt like a sheet of metal pressing down on the cherub's huge frame. Next to Hesse, though, Darris looked like he was having the time of his life. Pavel had compacted into his dome shape, but he bounced in place. Allie was glad for the hydraulics he had installed. Allie turned back to Dolan and shrugged. "I've seen them on the field. More than I can say for your choice," he said, nodding toward Ramal, whose nose looked permanently upturned. "Discarding him was not an option," Dolan said, every delivery dry as a bone. In the past 12 hours, Ramal had practically built a home up Dolan's butt. He seemed to exist solely to run around getting Dolan things. Apparently the Fontizian elders had sent him as Dolan's backup, which was kind of hilarious seeing as Dolan could snap this kid's spine with a single finger. Ramal was tall but scrawny as hell, and other than a skill in delivering messages in the key of wine, Allie couldn't see what good he could offer. They burst through the atmosphere, and the pace of the craft slowed, the pressure easing up on Allie's chest and limbs. He exhaled in relief. Darris, the Oostralite, made a loud, guttural noise somewhere between a growl and indigestion. Ramal put his index and middle fingers to each eye, a gesture to Vadhan, thanking him for his mercy. Allie'd seen his own parents do it 1,000 times, in another life, back before the Ray. Allie couldn't help but notice that Dolan only tightened his hands into fists. He had mentioned he was no longer part of the Order. Allie wondered why, and whether that had been his choice to break his vows. "We got visual," Hesse said, his milky white pupils locked onto the dash. "Should be appearing to the naked eye in 10, 9, 8. When the Nanak came into view, Allie summed it up as the ugliest ship he'd ever seen. But who needed it to be pretty when all it was good for was breaking up rock, digging deep, extracting whole swaths of precious metals? It was clumsy and greedy and pretty hateful work. A red light began to blink on the console. "Nanak, this is Yavau," Hesse said in his thickest, twangiest cherum accent. It made Allie miss Jeff. Hesse was the only soul aboard their craft who belonged to a collusion-allied territory. Darris might pass for Northern Oostralite or a sympathizer, if he was lucky, but they couldn't take any chances. According to the plan, Hesse'd greet the crew first, buying them at least a few precious moments to get into position.
"We're ready to attach and refuel whenever you are, over."
"Yavau, this is Nanak. Thank ancestors you showed up," a guy's voice answered. "We're ready to receive you once we get your confirmation code, over."
Allie realized he'd been gripping his armrest. His knuckles had already gone white.
"The confirmation is razor's edge," Hesse said. "Over."
5 seconds passed. 10. Then 15.
"Chartois," Allie mumbled under his breath. What if they had the code wrong? With one exchange with Uniforce,
they could be labeled combatants and be blasted out of the sky without a second thought.
The Cherim's albino eyes went wide.
What do I do?
You don't do anything, Dallin said. We only wait.
Where exactly did you get this code from?
Allie spoke in a whisper, even though the comm was still off.
We received it from a reliable source, the Cherim said. One of our scouts on the inside.
I don't like it, Ramal addressed the comment specifically to Dallin, with an expression that was the worst combination of miserable and pained, like he needed to go to the bathroom. Dallin ignored him. Nobody else volunteered a response. But it was a possibility that the scout had double-crossed them, and they all knew it. The seconds stretched out as they sat in silence, giving the console the death stare, like they could reach in and strangle the guy until he accepted the code. And then,
Sorry, Yavow. Code confirmed. You're cleared to attach and begin fueling, over.
Ali exhaled. He looked around at their crew, and his eyes landed on Dallin.
Phase two?
Phase two. Dallin nodded. Time to steer us in, he said to the Oostralite. Darris took the throttle with one of his tentacles and started to steer, positioning the airlock across from the Nanix.
I don't like it, Ramal repeated.
Dallin glared at him.
You wouldn't speak against a direct order, would you?
Never, Ramal said, looking down sheepishly. It's only that you can't be risked.
Dallin's cool eyes flickered toward Allie, but he stayed focused on Ramal.
My life is no longer anyone's concern but my own. It is no more valuable than any WFC soldier's.
What a hero, Allie said.
I don't play hero, Dallin said. That's your job.
Allie bit the inside of his cheek, searching for some smart-ass comment to make. But he had wanted to be a hero, once. He'd wanted to rise above his refugee status, find Rhiannon, help Kara, and maybe make her fall in love with him. But there was no time for shame, regrets. All this thinking and moping when they were at the cusp of capturing the very man who'd started it all. Allie needed this mission to succeed. He needed his revenge. He didn't have an order, or an elder, or anyone who would beg him not to go and get himself killed. He didn't have anything else. The silence in the pod was palpable as they all got into positions. Allie stood on the right of the doorway while Dallin and his messenger stood on the left, just out of sight from the Nanic crew, who'd be standing at the threshold. Hesse and Darris stood front and center to meet them with a toolbox each. The plan was to pick off the crew, take control of their ship, and descend onto Rhaeta before anyone knew the difference. For something so heavy and rusted, the door of the Nanic opened quickly. And just like that, Allie's boots were off the ground, and he was floating, turning in midair as he grabbed for the wall. Same with everyone else. There were the muffled sounds of shouting. He felt a chill run over his skin. Wrong. All wrong. Hesse drew a stunner from his belt as a guard who launched through the threshold brought a massive knife across his stomach. Blood arced through the room in a perfect parabola. In the fluorescent light, it was nearly transparent. Just like that? Chaos. Allie heard the staccato of heavy feet cross the floor, magnetic boots to keep them grounded. Allie, Dallin, and their crew had been played. It was the Uniforce's plan all along to disable the artificial grav on board. Kicking off the wall, Allie launched himself forward and tackled the Uniforce guy who'd slashed Hesse. The force of it knocked his magnetic boots off the grated floor, and the two of them sailed clear across the ship, breaking through a floating clot of blood as they wrestled. Allie got him in a chokehold, but the miner was strong and managed to get a boot back on the ground. Now that he was stationary, he used Allie's momentum and swung his body weight around. Allie flailed backward, blind to where he was headed. But Darris shot a tentacle out, lightning quick, wrapping it around Allie's waist to slow him down.
Then the Oosterlite wound a thicker tentacle around the other guy's ribcage and his neck and began to squeeze until the life left him. Darris unwound and gave him a shove, the still body floating up next to another miner whom Darris must have done the same. Allie untangled himself from Darris's tentacle and swam toward Hesse, who was in bad shape, globs of dark blood flooding out of his wound and beating up. He went to press down on the wound, but Hesse shook his head. Darris made a low, clicking noise as he motioned his head toward Dahlin. Two soldiers were tumbling and swiping at him at once.
"You must go," Darris said,
forcing his vocal cords to make the Raten words. He pressed a tentacle down on Hesse's wound. Allie swung across the craft to help Dahlin, looking over his shoulder to make sure Darris was okay. Then he heard Dahlin moan and saw that one miner held the Fontizian's arms behind him. Another threw a punch so hard, Dahlin's nose cracked audibly. Allie pushed off the center console and launched himself into the fray. As he floated toward the tussle, he saw that Dahlin was smiling. The blood from his nose made its way into the spaces between his teeth, and it dribbled down his chin. Dahlin threw his head back to hit the guy behind him, then forward to headbutt the guy in front of him. Allie started throwing fists at whatever flesh he could make contact with. Even though Allie was Uniforce trained, the miners had more experience in zero grav. They'd come prepared. One of them tackled Allie and punched him across the face. It felt like a part of his brain exploded. Their gloves were enhanced with special magnets, iron heavy. Allie brought an arm up to block his face, but the guy went for his ribs instead, and all Allie could do was knee and kick blindly as they settled on the floor. Another miner had pulled a knife on Dahlin, and they fumbled for control of it. The miner managed to pin Dahlin against one wall and drove the knife into his shoulder. Dahlin convulsed in pain.
"No!"
Allie yelled. He found a surge of strength and drove an elbow into his guy's face, then kicked him straight in the nuts. That was the downside of magnetic boots. Rooted in place, the guy felt the impact all the way to his eyeballs, while Allie's shot launched him in reaction straight across the craft toward Dahlin. The miner still clutched the knife, digging it into Dahlin's shoulder. Dahlin's knuckles were white and the veins in his neck bulged. He was shaking so hard his teeth were rattling. But Allie realized it wasn't out of fear or even pain. It was out of rage. Dahlin had the intense, focused kind of eyes that the real believers got in church when they were in ecstasy. When Vadhan called upon them, when they were driven by something bigger and more powerful and impossible to explain. Dahlin let out a scream as he pulled the knife out and lodged it into the other guy's throat in one swift motion. Suddenly, they heard the hiss of a door closing as the craft equalized, everyone, alive and dead, dropping to the floor with a thud. Gravity had been restored. When Allie looked up, he saw it was Ramal on the other side of the glass. He'd cut them off from the drilling vessel.
"No!"
Allie said, scrambling forward. He swayed on his feet as gravity planted him in place.
"Let us through the airlock glass," Dahlin growled.
His injured arm hung limp. The wound was wet and shiny, and Allie didn't know what kind of mess those tendons must be in.
"No," Ramal said, his voice shaking. "We've been compromised. They could be ready for you on the ground."
"Do not disobey me," Dahlin yelled.
The visor of his helmet was fogging up. Allie had never heard him sound angry before.
"Open this door immediately."
"I have explicit directions from the Elder to make sure you come to no harm," Ramal repeated. "You have a higher purpose."
Dahlin slammed both hands into the glass.
"If I can't live with honor, then I will die for it."
"Please," Allie said to Ramal, switching tactics.
He closed his eyes and could only see Kara.
"We'll stay alive together."
He hadn't realized until now how much Dahlin's expulsion had made him reckless, mad. But he didn't have time to play therapist. They'd need to release their craft soon, or the extra weight would slow them down and they'd all burn up into the atmosphere. Ramal only shook his head,
unyielding.
May I?
Pavel asked Allie politely as he opened a side hatch and exposed an array of attachments. Signal interceptors, wire cutters, surge amps he might use for getting the airlock open again.
Do it, Allie said. There's no use, Ramal said. I'm sorry.
His hand hovered over the button that would send them spinning way off course.
Don't! Allie yelled.
Too late. Ramal smashed his hand against the button. The force of the separation threw Allie to the floor. When he righted himself, the planet was already spinning away. Chapter 18. Kara. Since the ceasefire had been announced, all kinds of crafts had been swarming just below the Raetan atmosphere, navigating the enormous splinters of old planetary mass still swaying loosely in an electromagnetic net. Kara couldn't ID them by sight, but she knew the traffic was made up largely of Uniforce and Collusion crafts. It had been 3 hours since Kara and Issa had landed, and they were losing the light. The growing darkness was entirely different than anything Kara had experienced on Cebu, or any other planet for that matter. The absence of light on Raeta felt thick, total, scary. She felt it around her ankles, curling in and around her chest, alive with dust and debris. She was afraid it would reach out to strike. Or maybe it was her future, hidden somewhere on this rock, that was slowly rising up, waiting to crash down on her. The occasional discarded sign of life, a half-melted doll, at one point, made her queasy. Before Raeta had been bombed and its atmosphere turned lethal, the iron in its soil made the ground a fiery assortment of reds and oranges. Like the sun set and melted itself right into the land, Allie told her once. He had always said things exactly the way she wanted to hear them. She should have seen right through the promises, the charm, the smile. But that was Allie all along, the opportunist, the actor. Kara tried to imagine it as she walked across the cold, dead rock beneath her. It was one of the biggest intact pieces of Raeta, and when she looked up at the dark sky, she could see the remnants of the decimated planet. Pieces of rock just like the one she stood on. Issa's unit had dropped them on a nearby space station, and from there, Issa and Kara had been jettisoned via a pod, claiming they needed to recover a lost asset in orbit, after which Issa had steered them to the surface of Raeta. With half their fuel, they landed on a barren stretch of torn-up rock a full day's walk from the site of interest. The WFC couldn't dedicate any extra soldiers to escort them. If they had known the real reason the girls had come to Raeta, the WFC would have sent its entire army. The lie suited Kara's purposes just fine. A two-person pod was hardly likely to attract radar attention from the Uniforce. They might even be mistaken for pieces of the planet, breaking free of the electromagnetic cordon. Besides, she didn't need more military or anyone extra involved. She was going to find the Overrider and destroy every memory that had ever existed of Jocelyn Ta'an. It was only a matter of time before someone else tried to kidnap her. Jocelyn's existence had already compromised Rhi's reign, which made her vulnerable to Nero. Everything depended on this mission. To calm herself, Kara repeated, Etra, Rillurinus, Samba, the Wolf, the Guardian, the Matron. These were the star coordinates that would bring them to the lab and to her mother's old greenhouse. Kara was sure that they would find the Overrider there. By her calculations, only a matter of kilometers separated them from the site. Still, it was too far to walk before sunset. They would have to use Issa's WFC-issued dome to set up camp for the night. The spacesuits they were wearing were about two sizes too big, which made them bulky and downright archaic, and ill-equipped, apart from a simple readout of breathable oxygen and the position of the sun. Kara and Issa couldn't even talk to one another. The suits were fitted with comm units so old they might have stopped working during the Great War. But they got the job done in every other way. They could move through an otherwise lethal atmosphere, and the suits cloaked their heat signature, so they couldn't be tracked unless they were in visual range. The surface might be crawling with Nero's soldiers, but at the very least, they couldn't be tracked from a distance. And anyway, Kara should be thankful. If the dust and debris on Rata didn't kill you, the temperatures would. Even Issa couldn't prepare for a climate that had changed this dramatically. The ground was iced over, slippery as a fish, and they had to worry about losing their footing and floating off into deep space. And if you drifted off, the odds didn't look good. You'd either die of starvation or a suit malfunction, whichever came first. Their only contingency plan was a harpoon gun Issa carried. If Issa lost her footing and started to float off, she could shoot the loaded arrow into the ground and tether herself to the surface with a rope just 10 hands long. And if Kara floated away, Issa would still shoot the harpoon and grab for her. At least, that was the plan. It depended on everything working like it was supposed to, and a whole lot of trust in Issa. "I'm not going anywhere," she remembered Allie saying when they'd first got to Naufruma. She shook the thought away. Memories were like poison seeping into her skin, flowing into her heart. The past was venom, and Kara would get it out. She'd free herself and everyone else. Kara stayed right behind Issa, matching her step for step. They walked carefully, planting their feet so that the whole sole made contact with the surface. It was slow and dangerous. It was worth it, though. She just wanted this feeling to go away, that she was useless in this world, that she was a shell of a person, chained to her past. What future could she serve? And what could she even offer Rhiannon if she were found? No responsibilities, no painful past, no prodigal empress to live up to. Kara could make it all go away, and she could be whole again. She could help Rhiannon by disappearing, giving her the title of empress uncontested. At least she would have done some good. When they crested the hill, they saw a small white dome in the distance. Uniformed soldiers had made a camp for the night. Kara froze. The suits cloaked them, but for how long? Issa made a fist, and Kara recognized it as a signal to stop and crouch down. She did, her heart hammering. Issa crouched down too, and turned to Kara. Beneath the film on her visor, her eyes were bright with excitement or fear. Kara couldn't tell which. In the distance, the dome glinted in the light and looked like metal. The bomb had destroyed everything else. The dome had definitely been erected after the Great War. It was the first structure they'd seen since they started walking. There was something eerie about seeing the Uniforce here, on this terribly wounded planet. It was like stumbling onto a vision not of the past, but the future. Issa pulled out her handheld. The readout said they'd walked 30 kilometers from their landing spot. And, judging by the constellations, they had twice that to go before they reached the site of the lab, where Kara was sure the Overrider must still be concealed. They'd have to put distance between themselves and the Uniforce encampment, so they had a solid lead in the morning. They kept walking, slogging onward in their cumbersome and heavy suits, every step an agony of effort. Finally, long after the light from the Uniforce camp had dwindled into nothing, Kara could go no further. They agreed to sleep 4 hours, long enough to recharge, but short enough they could be sure they would still outpace the Uniforce if they too were on the move. Issa tapped the portable shelter. It was the size of her fist, but as it opened, it domed around them, settling into the ground with a whoosh of wind that knocked Kara backward. The air pressurized,
and the wrist consoles on both their suits beeped a weak green. 80% breathable oxygen for humanoid species. Kara figured they should be cautious, but Issa ripped her helmet off and gulped in a breath of air. A few seconds passed, and when it seemed sure Issa wouldn't suffocate or implode, Kara fumbled for the heavy metal zipper that connected her helmet to her suit, and pulled. The air was so cold it felt like frost lined her lungs with every inhale. She didn't care. Kara took in a deep breath, and then another. It made her head light, but she felt more alert. "I've never seen one of these domes," Kara said. It was pitch black inside, apart from their wrist readouts. But even in the dim green light, she saw her breath fog. There was something familiar about it, an eerie sense that events were replaying themselves. It had happened more and more in the last few days.
"They use them here when the dust started to collect in the atmosphere, before the evacuations happened," Issa said. "Guess these structures never made their way to Kalu."
Issa's tone was loaded.
"And why not?"
Kara felt terrible. She'd been so focused all this time on her own sense of loss that she hadn't really had any room to think about Issa's. She wondered what else Issa had seen that Kara had never even thought of before. She wondered what it would have been like to grow up here, back when it was different, when it was beautiful. She wanted to ask, but she didn't even know where to begin.
"No, they didn't."
Kara sat down opposite Issa and crossed her legs on the floor but said nothing. As loyal as Issa was, she didn't seem the type to open up. And Kara suddenly realized how badly she wanted to know her, to understand her, to learn her secrets. This girl who had risked her life to protect the WFC back on the Medcraft and the Medcraft itself, who had tried again and again to protect Kara, even from herself.
"Do you want to talk about it? The evacuation, I mean."
Issa sighed and leaned back, pressing her palms into the ground. She looked around.
"I didn't grow up on Rayta."
Kara was surprised. She had just assumed Issa was from here.
"My grandpa on my mother's side immigrated to the northern hemisphere of Kalu when she was a little girl," she explained. "I was born there, so I'm technically Kalusian."
She looked down and turned her wrist console off, so Kara could no longer see her face. Kara turned her own off, too, and they were plunged into darkness. Like before, the dark felt alive. It made Kara uneasy, more than uneasy, but she got the feeling Issa wanted to remain unseen.
"And?"
"He tended a vegetable stand that turned into a grocery store, that turned into all the vending machines of produce across every city on the planet," Issa said.
"Your family owned those?"
Kara said, wrapping her arms across her chest as she shivered. There was one at the Hyperloop station by her old module with Lydia, but it had looked old and rusted, and it was never stocked.
"We didn't own them, but my family's company, their labor, was the reason those stayed stocked. My mom inherited the business and turned it into a massive transport operation. Partnerships with farms outside every major city. Every yield from every harvest was distributed. We were doing good.
More than comfortable," she said, like she was embarrassed. "But then, the executive order happened." Kara rocked herself, partly to keep warm, but partly because she was nervous. Of course she knew what happened, without Issa having to say it. It was leading up to the Great War, an evacuation order for all Raytons on Kalusian soil. She combed her mind for an organic memory of it, though she realized she had none. Her own ignorance opened like a gulf between her and Issa. Issa continued. "Anyway, a man and a woman came to our house. He was a Kalusian in an oversized business suit. Said he was from the bank. She was wearing army fatigues and walked like something was stuck up her ass." Kara heard Issa spit then.
He said that under Executive Order 23-41B, anyone of Rayton or Fontizian descent would have their assets seized, and they'd have to be relocated to camps. For our safety.
What a bullshit excuse, Kara said.
She'd heard that way too many times. In the defense of things done to her, things that were inexcusable.
You went?
She couldn't know for sure.